Concord, it's 46 degrees. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. In a vote that's become a major talking point this election year, the U.S. House recently passed a budget known as the Ryan Plan. Republicans call it a path to prosperity for a debt-ridden nation. President Obama calls it radical and social Darwinism, while our guest today, New Hampshire 2nd District Congressman Charlie Bass, preferred as a first option another plan. Last month, Bass and several other members tried to gather support for a plan that represents a budgetary middle ground. Their approach was based on the work of the Simpson-Bowles Commission, a bipartisan, presidentially appointed panel that crafted a budget blueprint last year, which both cut spending and raised taxes. But as soon as their bill was put forward, it was attacked by both the right and the left. In the end, it received only 38 votes, and so Congressman Bass ended up supporting the Ryan Plan. Today in The Exchange, Congressman Bass is here to talk about this and struggles over federal transportation funding, also a controversy that's affected Bass personally, charges that his campaign 2 years ago didn't follow disclosure rules in polling. Let's hear from you too. Second District voters, it's your chance to talk with your congressman. What do you hope the U.S. House accomplishes this year? How hopeful are you that Congress will move forward on the issues that matter to you? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Congressman Bass joins us by cell phone. He's on his way to our studio, but there's an enormous accident on Interstate 89. So for now, he's stuck. He joins us by cell phone, though. And Congressman Bass, welcome. Thanks for your time this morning.
Hi, Laura. I'm so embarrassed to be out here because I'd like to pride myself with getting to these events on time, but I can give you a firsthand report because I'm approaching the accident right now near Exit 2, which is Clinton Street, and we should be there within the next 10 minutes.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, for now, Congressman Bass, let's just deal with that push-pull issue first. That's really been in the news here. The Attorney General's Office has charged your 2010 campaign not properly identifying itself on a poll during your race against Anne McLean Custer. Your spokesperson, Congressman, has vigorously denied this. Can you tell us in your own words your response to this charge from the AG's office?
Sure, Laura, and I'll have to limit it a little bit because obviously you hear this many times when there's pending litigation, there's limits on what you can discuss or not discuss. But let me just say that the push-poll law that was passed back in the 90s designed to stop a practice which existed then where campaigns or some independent groups would conduct polls from, you know, somewhere other than New Hampshire. They would make 50,000 or 100,000 calls for a dime apiece. And, you know, say if you knew that John Doe or Mary Smith ate their dogs and cats for breakfast, would you still vote for them and then hang up? The law clearly delineated what constituted a push poll. It had to be conducted by an entity that was independent of any candidate or any candidate committee. Now, the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee is definitely a campaign committee. That's in its name. And so just by definition alone, it could not possibly be interpreted under this law as being a push poll. This was a message testing issue poll similar to those that were run at the time by, we would assume, all of the other campaigns. And so I don't know where this is headed, but I didn't feel that it was appropriate to do anything other than allow this to go its course, because the Bass campaign 2010 doesn't feel that there was any law violated at all.
Well, the AG obtained an email in which one of your campaign staffers suggested that using the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee as the sponsor instead of your campaign, he wanted to do this because, in his words, "I'd rather have issues about push-pulling blamed on them than us, especially with the date rape drug question in there." So it sounds like, Congressman, your campaign was aware that this had the potential to cause controversy, and you wanted to avoid that.
Well, I would suspect that conversation may occur between a lot of different campaigns, but it was clearly, inappropriate remark by that particular campaign staffer, but it didn't have doesn't have any bearing at all on the actual law. And so the fact remains that this is not a push-pull under the definition of the law, and I can't imagine how, in the end, any judge or jury would ever construe it any differently. It's impossible to maintain that the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, which shared in the cost of the poll, is anything other than a campaign committee. It's not an independent committee, and if it's not an independent committee, it's not a push-pull. It's black and white.
So are you saying this email from the staffer is is misspoken?
I'm not going to comment on anything other than the fact that that under the definition of it contained in the law, this cannot be interpreted as being defined as a push-pull.
So it was more what did you call it earlier, a message testing issue?
Message
poll.
Issue testing is what most polls are conducted for. This is basically pretty standard.
All right. Well, Congressman Bass, recognizing that this is in court, maybe we'll talk more about it when this case is finally resolved. But I did want to move on to another huge issue with you, and that's the issue of the Ryan budget. Lots of headlines. President Obama is using this in his reelection campaign. Mitt Romney is using this in his presidential election. I want to ask you about the Ryan plan that passed recently and has caused so many waves in our national discourse. You, though, at first decided to support another plan based on what's called the Simpson-Bowles Commission. First of all, just remind us what that commission was and what the outline of its approach towards deficit reduction was.
Two and a half years ago, the president appointed a bipartisan commission on deficit reduction. In fact, former Senator Judd Gregg was a member of that commission and supported its recommendations. And it did make those recommendations at the very beginning of this Congress, January of 2011. The recommendations were immediately rejected by the White House. The president's budget for 2012 didn't contain any of them. The leadership of both the Senate and the House, the Senate being controlled by the Democrats and the Republicans in the House, rejected its findings. And then we spent, as we all know, the next year defining our positions, our principles. The Democrats had a budget, the president had a budget, the Republicans had a budget, and basically in the end we had no budget. The Senate hasn't had a budget passed now for over three years, and I don't believe that this is the way government should be run. So there isn't any question in most listeners or Americans' mind as to where Republicans stand on the budget priorities versus the Democrats. But the problem is that this country is stuck between a mountain of debt and a fiscal cliff at the end of the year. And I'll just point out four or five things that are going to happen. The early 2000 or Bush-era tax cuts all will expire at the end of this year, which will increase taxes, be a tax increase for primarily working Americans of about $4.6 trillion. The temporary payroll tax holiday will expire. That's a $1 trillion tax increase over 10 years at least. Sequestration, which was a product of that special committee, will expire or will go into effect rather, and that'll increase or reduce spending rather across the board by $1.2 trillion. We'll have to vote on a debt limit increase with no accomplishments to justify it. We have a doctor's fix for Medicare patients with a cost to the government of about $310 billion. We have no reconciliation, the alternative minimum tax. You can go on and on. And so I believe that it's time for having stated our principles, for us to start negotiating and resolving these problems. Now, some say that we'll wait and do it in a lame duck session because somehow there'll be a completely different view on the part of the membership. That's never happened before, and it's not going to happen again. And I think Americans are really fed up with all this squabbling and partisanship and so forth. And so I just stepped forward about a month and a half ago, or 3 months ago rather, and said I will be willing to put my name on this and bear the consequences of it because I think it's in the best interest of Americans.
So would it have increased taxes, Congressman Bass?
What it does is, which is similar to the Ryan budget, it calls for fundamental tax reform, establishing
a lower rate with tax expenditure reform, i.e. eliminating loopholes and so forth, and sets the rate at such a point where over the next 10 years, it would be forecast to raise an additional $1 trillion in revenue. And the Ryan budget is similar to that, except it's set at a point where it's revenue neutral.
Can I just interrupt you there for a second?
But the Gibson-Bowles budget also contains recommendations for approximately $3 trillion in spending reductions, both in entitlements and in discretionary spending. So it represents, frankly, a compromise position, which is where we're going to end up anyway.
Well, and I want to ask you about that. Definitely take one piece at a time. So on the tax reform, and I know everybody's afraid to say raise taxes, so they say tax reform instead and close loopholes and so forth. But at some point, somebody's going to pay more if you eliminate their loophole. So who would end up paying more under this Bull-Simpson compromise plan that you and others worked on?
Well, in the end, it's basically a plan. There's not the Ways and Means Committee would have the responsibility of outlining the specifics. But what it would do is set a new tax rate that would be almost universal. There would be two tax levels, one between 25 and 29, or 24 and 29%, another for low-income individuals. And then on top of that, there would be elimination of some of these tax expenditures, deductions, tax credits, and so forth. My guess is that they would primarily affect higher-income individuals. So in the end, you know, there would be a lower and simpler tax code. And for those of us who are doing our taxes right now, you know, we know how complicated this can be. And there would be some increased revenue because we need to get this budget balanced.
All right, Congressman Bass, we will talk more after a very short break, and hopefully we'll see you in studio soon. 1-800-892-6477 is the exchange number. Join us, 2nd District voters. It's your chance to talk with your congressman at 1-800-892-6477.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, from Bon Hag Associates, a local multidiscipline engineering consulting firm, providing solutions for sustainable and renewable energy systems. Information at bonhagassociates.com. And from Rothwangel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at rothwangeldentalcare.com. More on the changing political landscape here in New Hampshire with Congressman Charlie Bass. And coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke weighs in on March employment numbers. New Hampshire weather for today, more clouds and gusty winds with passing showers throughout the state. Highs ranging from 50 degrees across northern areas to near 60 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with New Hampshire's 2nd District Congressman Charlie Bass and getting his take on events on Capitol Hill, especially all the politicking around the budget lately. Let's hear from you, too. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Congressman Bass, I'm glad you got out of that gnarly traffic jam on 89. Good to see you.
Do I sound a little better now?
You sound a lot better now.
Well, it was a little bit disconcerting talking about the Simpson-Bowles or La Tourette-Cooper budget while I'm walking across the parking lot getting on the elevator with other people. But anyway, I'm sorry that
it's not your fault. It happens to everybody. So just to quickly revisit, sure, if we could, as we said in the earlier segment of our program, you and 37 other folks on Capitol Hill, Republicans and Democrats, supported a bipartisan budget plan based on the recommendations of the Presidential Commission known as Simpson-Bowles, a commission which was almost instantly rejected by everybody when its recommendations came out. Without going into too much detail, Congressman Bass, we were talking about who would pay more under the Simpson-Bowles? I know it comes with tax, with spending cuts as well, but who would pay
more
specifically?
Well, as we will discuss when we reach the Ryan budget discussion as well, budgets don't tell you who pays more, who pays less. They give basically what's known as reconciliation instructions, in this case to the Ways and Means Committee, because they do tax law. And the instructions, in essence, say that whatever you do, it won't have an adverse impact on low-income working Americans, A, and B, it will seek to establish a simpler tax code with fewer tax levels of taxation. That would be somewhere between, according to the instructions, 24% and 29%. And it's instructed to address the issue of repatriation, to address some of the spending issues such as sequestration, the doc fix, AMT, and so forth in that package. It doesn't get more specific than that, nor does any budget.
Because is that kind of passing off the work to somebody else?
Yes. Well, that's what a budget – that's exactly what budgets do. They're not signed – they're not laws. These are resolutions of our planning document for the Congress, which contains instructions to the committees. For example, the Energy and Commerce Committee, where I sit, would have reconciliation instructions from the Budget Committee for Medicare and Medicaid, and maybe some other, communications issues like FCC and so forth for revenue, spectrum auction, and so forth.
FCC's Federal Communications Commission.
That's correct.
In charge of the broadcast airwaves.
What the La Tourette Cooper budget attempts to do is to give outline the principles, which is what the Ryan budget does, and by the way, all the other budgets that were considered. But it leaves the specifics up to the committee of jurisdiction, in this case, Ways and Means. But what it does do in its forecast for revenues versus expenditures is include or set numbers that are higher for revenue than the Ryan budget over a 10-year period of approximately $1 trillion. And this would be achieved through, A, simplification of the tax code, B, elimination of tax expenditures, deductions, credits, and so forth that don't necessarily benefit the nation.
And
would have the net effect of increasing revenue. But at the same time, it would have to be balanced and linked with significant spending reductions as well, both on the entitlement side as well as on the discretionary side.
Sure. And we maybe should use the past tense when we talk about this La Tourette plan, because it failed. It only got 38
right.
votes. Here's a question for you, though. You said that the plan that you supported initially, this bipartisan plan, brings in more revenue than the Ryan plan, which you ultimately supported, but does so through, closing loopholes and so forth. Pardon my skepticism, but boy, everybody says we could bring in a gazillion dollars if we would just close all these bad loopholes. But then when you get down to the specifics, industries come in and say, don't close my loophole, don't close my loophole, and then you end up back at square one.
Make no mistake about it, that issue would be very divisive and controversial, and there will be very strong opposition from those groups of individuals that are affected by it. But how else are we going to get to where we need to go? And what this budget sets forth is the framework through which the committees that have jurisdiction can make specific recommendations to the Congress, which I will consider. And if I think it achieves what it needs to and it doesn't adversely affect the economy, I'm going to support it.
Why do you
and
think
it'll
only-
be you know, I know these are this is tough, but I think that's what Americans expect us to do.
Why do you think only 38 members of Congress supported this bipartisan plan?
Well, we had a press conference about four months ago, and there were 100 members of Congress at the press conference that essentially endorsed exactly what was brought to the floor. I don't want to try to interpret the motives of any other member of Congress except to say that I think that if you support something in a press conference, you really should give serious thought to supporting it when you have to put your finger on the button and vote yes. And it's up to those individuals to try to figure out how they would justify this in the future. Because I will tell you now, I think you can take this to the bank. We will, in the next year, be either considering or passing something that is going to be very close to this, and it will be supported by both Republicans and Democrats. And you will note that when this bill came up, the Republican chairman of the Budget Committee yielded most of his time in opposition to us. And on the Democratic side, I don't think there was anybody in opposition to it. I can't remember the debate that clearly. But so the point is that everybody in the Congress was being very careful because they know that this is the responsible way to do what Americans want us to do, which is to solve these big problems now.
So if this plan was so good, why did you then turn around, Congressman Bass, and end up voting for the Ryan plan?
Because we're in the majority. You can't be against having any budget at all. I think everybody has an obligation to vote for a budget. Now, I know that, you know, the Democrats all voted against the Republican budget, but the Republican budget that I supported is a budget that sets forth principles which I support, which lead to lessening of the growth of government, stabilizes taxes, and it is a step in the right direction. It's obviously not my first choice, but I believe that we have to have a document that we can use as a guide to move forward on, despite the fact that the Senate doesn't have any budget at all. So I'm happy to defend my vote on the Ryan budget, but I believe that the Simpson-Bowles or La Tourette-Cooper budget is the way that this country needs to go.
Okay, well, let's take some calls, Congressman. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. You can post your comments on our Facebook page. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Jillian is up first from Hudson. Hi, Jillian. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question about the Ryan budget and Medicare, because I've heard that, you know, since the Ryan budget includes this option of vouchers toward private plans, that, you know, a lot of the healthier people and younger people in Medicare would go toward this, and then traditional Medicare, you know, would basically become unaffordable because it would only have the much older and sicker people who couldn't get other plans. So I'm just wondering, you know, why the congressman would vote for such a plan that would, you know, possibly destroy this important social safety net for people.
You're talking about Medicare, Jillian?
Yes, Medicare.
Okay. All right.
Fair question, Jillian. First of all, the way to assure that there will be no Medicare for younger people is to do nothing, because even the trustees all agree that Medicare is on a path to bankruptcy, and Republicans and Democrats alike cannot dispute that at this point. I would point out that the plan that was proposed in both the Simpson-Bowles budget as well as in the Ryan budget does not affect anybody over the age of 55. So it has no significant fiscal impact during the life of the budget, but it does recognize a problem with this trust fund that needs to be addressed now rather than at the last moment. Secondly, it is an interesting plan because it's modeled after essentially the Part D prescription drug plan, which has been very successful. It's come in consistently under budget. Seniors are pretty happy with it. We don't get very many complaints in our office about it. And unlike the budget that was proposed last year by the House Republicans, this proposal for Medicare is bipartisan. Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat in the Senate, and Congressman Paul Ryan, chairman of the Budget Committee, have talked about this now for 3 or 4 months. And the major difference between this and last year's budget is that seniors will have alongside a premium support program, the traditional Medicare from the federal government.
That was the issue of contention. Premium support, people called it vouchers,
well,
said
vouchers
it would be limited.
Vouchers is a little bit of a, you know, that's a political term. I think the technical term is premium support, similar to the Part D prescription drug plan, where seniors get choices to purchase health care plans which are paid for by the federal government, or if they don't want any of them, they can go with what they have now. And I think that's a reasonable way to start addressing this issue of potential bankruptcy.
Here's a question that I actually saw in the Concord Monitor last week or the week before from David in Amherst. And David, I apologize for using your comment on the air, but it's one that I have seen repeatedly. He says, Bass's record shows protecting Medicare by dismantling it. He voted for Paul Ryan's plan to end Medicare as it is now and instead hand out vouchers to buy insurance plans from private companies. Here's the point that I want to ask you about, Congressman. He says, what the vouchers are worth would vary from year to year. There's no assurance they would cover the cost of an insurance plan. There's no assurance private plans would cover pre-existing conditions. I wonder if premium support gives you a set amount of money. You know, what happens if you fall that year and you have a lot of hospital bills?
Well, first of all, Medicare is, by definition, accommodating pre-existing conditions because you qualify for it whether you when you turn 65,
everybody
regardless
gets
of whether
it.
You're running 10 miles a day or you're in a nursing home. So pre-existing conditions is not an issue. And I would point out that seniors will have the right, if they so choose, to remain in an existing plan similar to what they have today. But we have already seen with the Medicare Advantage program, which, by the way, the new health care law will essentially abolish, that seniors like to have choices which are reflective of their own priorities and interests for health care coverage. And that's what this does. And it creates competition between providers, which doesn't exist obviously today with what amounts to a single payer system. And it will, I think, result in some significant element of sort of natural cost control that'll exist through the competitive process and the ability for seniors to pick plans that best suit their needs. And if they don't like them, go with a plan that would be offered similar to what they get today.
Is there means testing associated with this?
Well, again, I want to get back to the fact that a budget is a planning document, not specifics, but I can't speak for the Ryan budget, but it certainly would be a option in the Simpson-Bowles proposal that that means testing would be on the table. It's been very strongly advocated for years now by the Concord Coalition and other fiscal responsibility advocacy groups. So I think means testing should be on the table as a way to reduce future costs.
How do you feel, Congressman Bass, about the idea that means testing, you know, on the one hand, you can see the argument, why should Warren Buffett, you know, get Medicare along with Laura Kanoi? Clearly, we're in a different income bracket. But the idea that it's a shared burden, we all pay into it, and so it should be a shared benefit. If you start means testing it, it makes it less universal and more of a welfare program.
Well, remember that you don't have to join Medicare when you turn 65. If you don't, there are penalties for failing to do so. So it isn't mandatory. But I would point out that I agree. This is a difficult issue. Medicare is a defined benefit health care program for older citizens that they pay for during their working lives. So, you know, there is a problem in my view, at least, you know, academically, means testing it. But on the other hand, there's an even bigger problem with its pending insolvency.
Let's take another call, Congressman. 1-800-892-6477 is our number for you to join us. And Dan's waiting in Dover. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Congressman Bass.
Morning. How are you, Dan?
Good, good. So I have a question related to energy.
Mm-hmm.
And given, you know, all the reports that have come out recently about, you know, U.S. oil production is the highest it's been in almost a decade, you know, from the fields and such, and that we actually produce so much gasoline now that we've become a net exporter of gasoline for the first time in 50 or 60 years. What? Why is gasoline so high, and what could the Obama administration or any administration, for that matter, actually be doing to really affect the price of gasoline, bring it down in the United States?
Dan, thank you very much. Yeah,
Dan, this is a great question, and it's a very difficult one, and it tends to, like most issues in a political year, get to be very political.
And you're on the Energy Committee, we should say.
I am. I'm on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and my view is that that energy, oil, gas, are global commodities, and the prices are set by supply and demand. And when there's a threat to the supply, which we obviously are facing now because of the situation in Iran and the Straits of Hormuz, you know, their potential nuclear capability, it is creating a feeling amongst those that are future consumers of energy that they'd better buy now for the future. And that's one of the reasons why the price is so high. Secondly, and again, I try to be as dispassionate about this as I can be, I think that the United States needs to say to the world that it is making its own efforts to develop its own supplies domestically through you know, development of the Marcellus gas range. We have now really a glut of natural gas, but also potentially offshore oil development, which would, and some drilling also in some of the areas up in the upper Midwest, in the Dakotas and so forth.
And there's a lot going on there already,
there is, from what I understand. But the problem is that the message that we tend – that the administration is given is that, this a priority is not a priority for them. I believe that it should – that development of existing resources should be a priority along with – and it's just as important – a continued focus on the development of alternatives as well. Energy is very regional, and around here we're interested in solar, wind, and biomass, and those alternatives are very important part of – should be an important part of our future energy mix.
You know, you mentioned this administration not making enough of a priority domestic production. Environmentalists have criticized President Obama, saying he's too focused on drill, baby, drill, to borrow a term. You know, he had a big press conference in front of all these oil rigs in Oklahoma, and he's gone about the country saying, you know, production is up, way, way, way up, more up than it's ever been before. So I'm just curious why you say this administration – hasn't made domestic production.
Well, without getting into details, because I don't like to quote people, but there have been comments that have come out of the administration to the effect that high gas prices are good for the overall long-term development of a different kind of energy policy for this country.
That was a couple years back, right?
That's correct. And I think that the climate change debate, all of it has had an impact on weakening the world's view of the United States' commitment to have a balanced energy plan. And I would suggest that since the Republicans have taken over Congress, there's been almost total focus on developing existing energy supplies such as oil, gas, and coal. And my view is that we ought to be considering alternative energy legislation as well. And to that effect, as you know, I have an efficiency bill that I introduced in January that will be taken up, hopefully, by the committee later this year.
Newt Gingrich said in his presidential campaign, this relates to our caller's question, what can politicians like you do? He said, elect me and I'll lower gas prices to $2.50 a gallon. To reiterate Dan's question, how much is there that any president or member of Congress can really do to affect gas prices?
The problem with energy prices, short of nationalizing the oil companies and turning it into a state-run energy system, which nobody is in favor of unless you like getting up at 3 a.m. in the morning to wait in gas lines as we did in the 70s, is that issues that affect gas, oil and gas prices are global. And so what we really need to do is to stabilize the situation in the Middle East and also get an energy bill, a real energy bill, going in the Congress that balances, negotiate with the Democrats over drilling for some focus on alternative energy development as well.
All right. More after a short break. Stay with us.
Today on Word of Mouth, a professor of bioethics offers some far-fetched strategies for coping with climate change. That includes engineering future generations of humans to be shorter, smarter, and more empathetic. Plus, the importance of neighborhood playgrounds. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth reaches for the monkey bars today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from You, our members, from Groponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Groponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at groponi.com. And from Goodwill Industries of Northern New England, reminding you that donations make a difference in people's lives. Details about the donate movement at goodwillnne.org/donate. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 2nd District Republican Congressman Charlie Bass is here, and let's hear from you, too. What do you hope the U.S. House accomplishes this year? How hopeful are you that Congress will be able to move forward on issues that matter to you, especially given election year pressures? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Congressman Bass, here's an email that came in from Susan, who says, thanks for your leadership on conservation during your career in New Hampshire. She says, given the current political climate and election year challenges, what do you see as the prospects for conservation in the House budget? And is the Transportation Reauthorization Bill a good vehicle for increasing funding for LWCF, as was done in the Senate. Just remind us what LWCF
is. Land and Water Conservation Fund. It's been a very high priority for me and also my predecessor, Judd Gregg, back when he was in the U.S. Senate. And as Susan probably knows, I spearheaded an effort last year to make sure that there was adequate funding provided for LWCF. I got circulated a letter to the Appropriations Committee with a whole lot of signatures on it, both Republicans and Democrats, to support the program. And I think it was pretty well funded last year, and I'll be doing the same thing this year. Even we'll possibly be proposing amendments on the floor as we did last year. Land and water conservation should be a very high priority on the environmental side. As far as attaching it to the transportation bill, with all due respect, that might be the worst place to put it.
Right, because this bill is stalled.
Transportation is stalled, and it's very
anywhere.
Controversial. I'm one of the, I think, three or four Republicans that wrote the speaker urging him to adopt, to move the Senate bill through the House, not because I think it's a great solution, but because I think we need a solution, and it would be a two-year solution, and it doesn't contain a lot of the extra legislative initiatives that the House bill has that's created this stoppage, if you will.
If I could ask you about that, Congressman Bass. We talked about this transportation bill with Senator Shaheen last week, and she said this bill is so bipartisan that the very liberal Barbara Boxer and the very conservative James Inhofe both signed off on it. Knowing the political leanings of those two senators as I do, I was stunned by that. So why isn't this good enough for the House?
And I would say at a New Hampshire level, if I see Senator Shaheen and Mark Charbonneau from Continental Paving, as conservative of Republicans you'll find, standing together supporting the bill, it's definitely not philosophical.
Right, so why isn't
Here's
this good
problem.
Enough for the House?
Here's the problem. The Senate bill is a two-year bill. It doesn't have any new revenue sources for transportation. And although it's a simple and easy solution, at the end of 2 years, again, there's going to be a cliff because there will be nothing left at all in the Highway Trust Fund. So the House has tried to pass a five-year bill that establishes a new paradigm for revenue from other sources not related to the gas tax. That Senate bill doesn't attempt to do that, but what the Senate bill does do is provide certainty for the states and also the vendors, the contractors, so that we know what we can do for the next 2 years, and it provides enough funding to meet the numbers, for example, that have been passed in the state of New Hampshire's 10-year highway plan.
So,
and I think that's the easiest, relatively short-term solution, but it does not answer the long-term crisis that transportation has in that automobiles aren't using as much fuel, and the roads are deteriorating. They're getting older and older, and the economy has not bounced back, which would have provided more revenue for the trust fund, and the trust fund's going broke.
Well, so it's time for a new paradigm to fund highways. So where does the money come from, if not from gas taxes?
Obviously, raising the gas tax is not an option.
And why not?
Because everybody is worried about high gasoline prices. You just had a fellow, Dan in Dover, talk about why energy prices are so high. This is no time to be raising the gasoline tax on top of all the issues that working Americans face now trying to survive. And, you know, 4 years ago, gasoline was $1.75 to $1.89 a gallon. It's now over, in some places in New Hampshire, over $4 a gallon. And that is a rough situation for most people to deal with.
So where
and
does the money come from?
Well, the Republican transportation bill uses the royalty payments from future energy development, mostly drilling, to help fund it. It also there is a link, I believe, potentially to freezing federal pay, which is kind of a little bit, shall we say, not germane to transportation. But the House bill attempts to adequately fund the program, keep the Highway Trust Fund going for five more years, and over that period have that debate about when a wheel turns a revolution, that's where the wear and tear occurs, and so there should be some cost associated with that, regardless of whether it's an electric car or a hybrid or a gasoline-powered car, because an electric car doesn't pay any excise tax at all. because it doesn't use gasoline, and yet it's using the roads. So that's the debate, the longer-term debate that needs to occur.
Yeah, and some states are looking at that, not raising money through gas taxes, but miles traveled. Very controversial in rural states.
Very controversial, because then it means that, you know, when you register your car, you'd have to pay an additional tax, but then the excise tax on gasoline might be eliminated. But it's a debate for another day.
Well, and this has come up in New Hampshire. And one of the things that the House Republicans did was they took away a new vehicle registration fee that had meant $90 million for our own state transportation department. Lots of controversy about that. Was that a bad idea, Congressman Bass,
well,
given the dire state
issue
of our roads?
Laura, I'm not going to get into the debate over whether – I don't know what the you know, what the issues were at the time when it was either passed or repealed. Whether – I mean, there could have been issues that I wasn't aware of. So I hesitate to say whether it was either good or bad to either enact it or repeal it.
All right. Let's take another call, Congressman Bass. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Susan, thanks for that email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Waiting in Swansea is Patrick. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My question is, what more can we do to support the serious health needs of our veterans returning from overseas? An example of what I mean is Congressman Bass's successful efforts in getting our veterans' health clinic opened here in Keene last November, for which we here in the Monadnock region especially are very grateful. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Patrick. And we hear a lot, boy, lately, Congressman Bass, about veterans looking for work, high unemployment rates among returning vets.
Three or four quick points. First of all, the cost of this, of the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, is going to be felt by this society for the rest of my life and probably yours. It's been a very, very difficult war, especially on the physical and mental health of these brave people who have sacrificed so much for all of us. And the veterans' medical budget is exempt from all of these issues that I was talking about earlier in terms of sequestration and cuts and so forth. And in addition to that, as Patrick mentioned, it's important for the Veterans Administration to establish these clinics in Littleton, Keene, obviously the hospital in Manchester, White River Junction, and so forth. I would note that over the long term, I believe that we need to move the veterans' health care into a system that where a vet could go to any hospital, so that – and I hate to use the term voucher because that's associated with an earlier debate. But if veterans could go to Weeks Memorial Hospital or to Monadnock Community Hospital or to Cheshire Medical Center and get their services, then they don't have to drive to Manchester or to Boston or to Maine or to Vermont. And it would dramatically increase the convenience. And the veteran service organizations that represent veterans are becoming more and more supportive of this idea. And so over the long term
– Instead of building a full-fledged –
Well, instead of having a completely separate parallel system for veterans that is becoming increasingly difficult to work with especially with these new individuals coming into the system that need more complex care, that it might be better to utilize our existing healthcare system and hospitals, which are in many communities underutilized, and let the veterans go in there and get reimbursed by the VA. I like that concept, and I think it's one that we should work on at the federal level.
And Patrick, thanks a lot for calling in. And you know, Congressman Bass, you said we'll be paying the costs of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars for a long time. And I know you were talking about the physical and mental health costs of our veterans, but it did return my mind to the Ryan plan. And a huge critique of it is that while it makes enormous cuts in many programs, it doesn't touch defense. Democrats and some Republicans, Congressman Bass, have said, look, these wars are winding down. Why do we need to keep pumping up these defense budgets in light of cuts in other programs like transportation and the environment?
The Obama administration has set a baseline for defense spending that takes into account the drawdowns that are expected in the Middle East and calls for a roughly $400 billion reduction in the growth of defense over 10 years over what it would be if we stayed in Afghanistan for 10 years. The sequestration proposal, which I hope doesn't go into effect, would cut an additional $400 billion over 10 years out of
defense.
That's
the automatic cuts that are supposed to go
automatic cuts,
that
that's right, from that
budget
super
fiasco
committee
last summer.
Last year.
Got it.
And I think that, again, Democrats and Leon Panetta, the defense secretary, Democrat, along with the Republicans in this and Democrats in the House and Senate agree that this is too much, that we have to protect Americans both at home and abroad. And there's a minimum expenditure of resources that needs to be undertaken to do that. And so I think everybody will be working to try to eliminate the additional sequestration funding for defense, but it's not going to happen in a vacuum. It has to happen in the context of a much bigger solution, which eliminates all of that mindless across-the-board sequestration. We should be more responsible and be willing, as Republicans and Democrats, to address the issues of reducing the growth of spending across the board, but not across all programs, but not across the board.
You know what I'm struck by, Congressman Bass, is we're still sitting here talking about sequestration. We all remember the debt ceiling debacle back in August, and everybody agreed, okay, we can't agree, so we're going to agree to this sequestration, which involves, you know, deep cuts in everything, including defense. I just can't believe we're still sitting here talking about this.
Well, that's the whole reason why I broke with all but 37 other members of Congress and said, come on, you guys. It's gut check time in Congress, and the American people, nine out of ten of them think that Congress is doing a bad job. And if you dig into that, you find that the reason for that is that we can't seem to get past the bickering and squabbling and start solving problems. I have stated, and as have Democrats and Republicans for the last year and a half, our principles. There's no question, as I said earlier, what I stand for and what I don't. But the time has come to move forward and solve these problems. Nobody's going to be happy with the outcome, but if we don't start now, when are we? And as I said when I was walking in here in the elevator, expecting it to happen in a lame duck session of Congress is a bad way to plan.
Well, and we only have a couple minutes left, Congressman, and I didn't want to leave without asking you about the Northern Pass. Again, this is the giant hydropower proposal, bring hydropower down from Canada through New Hampshire and onto the New England grid. You sit on the Energy Committee, so I wanted to ask you about this. Just first of all, does your committee have any role, jurisdiction in this Northern Pass debate?
Well, we do, us and Foreign Relations Committee. It's from the State Department. The permit is actually called a presidential permit, and it comes through the State Department and the Energy Department, which would allow for the construction of the pipeline from Quebec down to Massachusetts. I mean, not pipeline, the power lines. So there certainly is jurisdiction, and it's a system that works pretty well. There's another controversial program that's involved in this system, and that's the Keystone Pipeline in the upper Midwest. My view is that that the Northern Pass project might have worked had it been properly planned from the beginning in a manner that would, in essence, attract the support of the North Country. That was not done, and now the developers are fighting the residents of Coos and Grafton County and Merrimack County and Hillsborough County to put this line in against their will. And I think that's a terrible mistake. And Senator Ayotte and I, over a year ago now, wrote a letter to the Energy Department voicing our opposition to this project in its current form. And there hasn't been enough of a change in the plan. In fact, there's been very little change to warrant any reconsideration of that view. And I just think it's, in my view, the developers need to get back to square one and start by bringing the communities into this debate and figure out if there's a way to do this that will change the economic paradigm, for example, of the North Country, which will not occur under the current scenario. It'll be very damaging to the tourism trade, to the value of real estate and so forth up there.
So you're agreeing with the critics, basically.
Yes, I do.
And what I'm unclear on, though, Congressman Bass, is where you come in, besides saying how you feel, which is important, obviously. You're a congressman on the Energy Committee, you're a congressman from the area, but is there something that eventually is going to come before you on the committee and you say yes or no?
No, the process is approval of a permit. It does not require confirmation by the Congress.
I see.
And it isn't practical to change the law because it would affect every other project in some fashion. This is working, frankly, the way it should. The federal agencies are considering it. People like Senator Ayotte and I voiced our opposition to it. The state of New Hampshire has taken action, as we know. And so at this point, it is where it is. I certainly hope that it doesn't go forward as it's planned now, because I really fear for the economic vitality of the northern part of the state.
Well, one last question.
But by the way, that's not to say that I don't support the energy itself, which is clean, renewable, hydropower. There's a lot of good reasons to do that, but we need to get it to market in a different manner.
The filing period for this year's elections ends in June to file for the 2012 fall elections. Will you be running again, Congressman?
Yes, I will. I'm looking forward to it. I have, I believe, done my best to provide the voters of this district with reasonable but forceful representation on the issues that I think are important. And I think this election will be an election about the big issues, where our nation will be 10 years from now, where our debt and deficit will be, where our, you know, what is the proper role for government to play in our society? Have we gone too far? Are there places where, you know, we can exercise frugality in order to preserve the economic vitality of this nation for future generations? And I hope this election is about big issues and not the kinds of issues that are divisive and personal.
Super quick. I heard a rumor that House Speaker Bill O'Brien might launch a primary bid against you.
I never discourage anybody from considering anything having to do with running for any office, and I look forward to running on my record and receiving the support and confidence of the New Hampshire people in November.
Congressman Bass, you went through great duress to come in here and talk to me today.
Laura.
Thanks
Anytime.
A lot for being here. Again, that's Charlie Bass, Republican Congressman from New Hampshire's 2nd District. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineers are Dan Colgan and Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern's Ryan Lessard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.